Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we do Mr. Brightside in this first half of the show. We talk to Dr. Mark McConville as well, who's he studies adolescence, and they'll tell you basically what to do with your 20-year-old or what to do with your 10-year-old, not to turn into the 20-year-old that I happen to know, or a few of them that I happen to know. Anyway, we'll get into that. First, I'll tell you about J.B. Weld. J.B. Weld, proud sponsor of the Adam Carolla Show, epoxy adhesive brand used by both pros and experienced DIYers, trusted for 50 years plus. And it's available at jbweld.com and retailers everywhere. J.B. Weld.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
The evil bitch that is coronavirus may still be raging outside, but Carolla Drinks is hard at work with another month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This month includes a Beard Bro beard-shaping tool to tame that unruly corona facial hair, and a Chew face mask so you can silently protest how f***ing stupid all of this is, a 6-foot premium beer bong by beerbong.com, so you can slug back a few cold, endless rants when the world officially opens up again. And, of course, a bottle of your choice. We know times are tough, but we at Carolla Drinks are here to remind you to take a breath, have a drink, and wait for all this shit to be over. Mahalo. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, clinical psychologist Mark McConville. With Gina Grad on news, Paul Bryan on sound effects, and Dave Damashek is here for good sports. And now, shame-filled self-promoter, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but get on. The mandate. You get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
And Bald Brian?
Boom.
Dr. McConville is going to be with us, clinical psychologist. Has got a book, Failure to Launch, Why Your 20-something Hasn't Grown Up and What to Do About It. Mm. Oh, boy. I got to tell you, I'm interested in talking to this cat because there's a new breed of cat out there, and that cat is an uncoachable cat. I know because
Feral.
I tried... A feral cat is the new breed of cat. I tried to hire my 19-year-old nephew. It did not work at all. And the problem was, well, it's twofold, which is I'm treating him like I'm talking to a 19-year-old version of myself, and right. I am not. There's something going on where, you know, when I was 19 and a 55-year-old guy who was really successful was trying to explain something, I wasn't thinking, watch your tone, old man. I was thinking, you get to do whatever you want with me because I'm 19 and you're that. Maybe it's the self-esteem movement. We'll figure it out.
That's funny.
Extra points if he brings up Grubhub or Fortnite.
Right. That's funny you mentioned that. What you mentioned 55 and 19. I just was taken back to when I was about 19 or maybe 20. Adam, do you know what an informational interview is? You probably don't.
I remember talking to you about it once or twice.
Yeah, like, so I don't even know if I assume they still do. Maybe they call it something else these days. Back in the day, I had an informational interview, obviously not a job interview, but I went to, I knew this very successful, he's probably about 55. His name's Tom Sherrick. He was the president of Fox, and I knew him through
Ooh, a phone.
Oh, yeah, I can get you a sit down with him just to pick his brain. I'm like, fuck yeah, absolutely. I just sat down with the guy for a half an hour. He did me a kindness, obviously, and he just kind of shed wisdom on me, some of which I still remember. One of the things he told me today, he said, I said, what's the advice you would give someone my age? He goes, never look back. No, never look back. I knew what he meant, which was never second guess yourself or never, you know, go back and doubt, you know, your whatever, you know, your choices are. Obviously, you can look back and evaluate whether your choices were good or bad, but I still remember it to this day.
I think of little generational differences between younger folks who work today and when I used to work, when I was had a, you know, a lot of lieutenants and generals above me because I was a private in this man's army. It's very much that way on a construction site. When you walk on as a laborer, you're low man on the totem pole, and it's your job to do whatever the carpenter tells you to do, or even the apprentice carpenter tells you to do, and it's never to question. And I don't want to sound like it's the military, but it has a kind of hierarchy right to it. But there are little things I stumble into that I don't know if you guys pick up on it. It happens to me a lot, and I try to filter it through my 19-year-old brain or even my 28-year-old brain, which is I have a lot of conversations with people who are beneath me on in the pecking order here where I say, hey, I told you to look this thing up or I told you to find that thing. And they go, you never said that. I thought to myself, it's very common. Chris does it to me a lot. It's not your fault, Chris. It's your age. But a lot of people say that. I've had Kaylin say, I've had many people say, like, you didn't tell me that. You didn't say that. It's a common refrain. And it sounds pretty basic, but it's also the kind of thing that would have never passed your lips if somebody in a position of power said to you, I told you to do this. Why didn't you do that? When you were 21 or 19, you would have never said you didn't tell me to do that.
Even if they didn't.
That's the part we have to drill down on. But it's a generational thing. I'm looking at Max Apat. He's disgusted. Max, how many times a week do you go, you didn't say that?
It's happened once or twice, sure.
Okay. But my point is it is your opinion that I didn't say that, which is fine. But in the past, it wasn't even acceptable to say that to the person that did or didn't say that thing to you. Some people look at that as evolution.
Okay.
But most don't.
He has to do it like he's being cross-examined. Not that I recall. I do not recall that.
So it's an interesting thing we can get into, and we'll talk to the doctor about that. I was also thinking, some of this is fresh off the conversation I had with Dr. Drew, who was in here about a half hour ago, but everyone is always talking about profiling, and you can't profile, and you don't want to profile. And I've always said, you can't not profile. It's built into us as human beings. Mm-hmm. You're asking people to do something that's in their DNA. And you can say, well, that DNA is evil. It's in us to try to figure out whether there's danger posed to us or not. And it's something we can't turn off. And I was thinking about a discussion I haven't had in many years, but it's very true, which is in terms of my own ethnicity and heritage. And I don't blame anyone who did it to me, but I've said it a few times, but it's been a while. The entire time I was a carpenter for many years, doing just flat out blue collar, you know, 15 years plus of helping people move, digging ditches, cleaning carpets, you know, spreading stucco and a little bit of mirth across this land. But the whole time I showed up in Canoga Park driving a pickup truck and had to get up on the roof of the industrial building, nobody ever mistook me for a Jew. No one ever thought I was Jewish the entire time I was driving a pickup truck. But as soon as
Congratulations.
I traded that pickup truck in for a BMW started going to Hollywood and writing jokes. And then
started grubbing some money.
Yes. Then I became a Jew. People go, you're Jewish. You know what I'm talking about. Like all of a sudden, even though my last name is Carolla, because I have nappy hair and I was sitting around the writer's table at the man show and I was a comedian, then people assumed I was a Jew. And Dr. Drew said, they shouldn't have done that. And I said, yeah, they should have. That they think fast. They don't think clear. They think a little too fast, but they're playing the odds.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of Jews wandering around construction sites in Canoga Park, and there are certainly more Jews writing comedy than there are Italians. Sorry, Jeff Cesario. So,
outlier.
I'm just saying, now look, it's a story and it's a harmless story, but it's what people do. It's how people are wired. All right. My book is out as we speak.
Speaking of Mazel Tov.
That's right.
I had a wonderful
101 ways to prepare gefilte fish.
Yeah. I was thinking about it's number one in self-help and psychology and political humor. Jesus
Jewish
Christ.
Studies.
So, yeah.
Oh, good vault.
That's awesome.
I had a moment. Thank you. I had a moment which was like, put my life perfectly into perspective, which is the cover is me with Phil on my lap and in an airplane. And I thought, if I go in to Natalia's room and show her the book cover, which is just released, and if I go, hey, your dad wrote his fifth book, she'll roll her eyes. But if I work the Phil angle, if I go in there and go, hey, your dog is on the cover of the book.
The cover of number one book.
On Amazon, right? So I get that in my head. I'm like, okay, yeah, don't make it about you. Make it about the dog. Because, you know, the dog provides so much for the family, of course. You know, the reason we have this beautiful home is because of Phil. The reason we have an abundance of food in the refrigerator and the pantry is because of Phil. The reason your orthodonture is perfect and you're able to drive around in a $100,000 Tesla. It's all Phil, the dog. We need to thank Phil the dog.
He doesn't get the credit he deserves. So really, we should be thanking him more.
So I thought, all right, well, let's not make it about you. Let's make it about Phil. So I got the computer. I went to Amazon. I clicked on it. I clicked on the picture, and there was just a big picture of me and Phil, and we were number one in political whatever. And I started to walk into Natalia's room with the computer open. I go, Natalia, I don't know if you know it, but your dad and your dog have made it to the top. And as I stepped into her room, she goes, Dad, shoes off, get out, shoes off. Because she's so freaked out about COVID and shoes. And I was like, fuck it. And I just went back to my office and closed the door.
This one's partly on you, man. You should have known because she's been on the cover of one of your books.
I know.
That's right.
What's going to move the needle at this point?
Nothing.
You can only go down from there.
Yeah.
All right. We have a clip of the audio book, which is on the top 100 overall on Amazon right now, and I'll tell you guys a little more about that. But what is the clip you pulled here, Dawson?
Well, we were talking about how companies have become very woke. Industry has become very woke recently. Mm-hmm. And you made the point that internet porn has jumped on it, and you had a few suggestions.
Oh. All right, here we go. Even internet porn got in on this awareness bullshit. In 2015, Pornhub launched Pornhub Cares, offering a donation to a breast cancer charity. Each time you offered a donation to the crusty sock you keep under your bed while watching videos in the big tits and small tits categories. Why is there even a small tits category? This must be because you can't have a 14-year-old runaway category. How low is your self-esteem if you're clicking on the small tits category? That's like watching a sports highlight reel called Greatest Foul Balls. Not only is this an unnecessary downer, no one wants to think about breast cancer while staring at some double Ds, except for maybe in Germany. But they also miss an incredible opportunity. They should have called the campaign Spray It Forward. That's the kind of high-minded humor you're going to find.
Number one in self-help.
It's
politics.
I know. But I got a lot of categories there now. So thank you. And
that's awesome.
I want to thank Post Hill Press for doing this because I went to all my former publishers who I was on the New York Times bestseller list three times. So I thought, well, I'll just go back to HarperCollins.
Three times, fool.
HarperCollins or Crown or whatever, whoever was doing what. And they're all like, no, thank you. Moving on. And it's a new world order out there. And they're, they, the New York publishers are about as woke as you get, and a lot has changed in the last 10 years. And everyone is super woke now, and nobody wants... I mean, what was that story? Oh, was Woody Allen wanted to publish his memoirs, and they, and all the kids walked out of the building?
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, think about that. The New York Times wanted to run an op-ed piece, or did run an op-ed piece by Tom Cotton, and the kids all walked out and got the editor fired. I mean, this is going to be a good subject for today, because these are the kids taking over the establishment. All right. Monterey, the race has been canceled.
Oh. No.
I know. Them.
Really doesn't make any sense from what we know right now.
Is that because some of the other surrounding events were canceled? They just, that was the last domino to fall, or what happened?
They basically just make the protocol such that it's impractical. It's kind of the Joel McHale rant with the swimming pool. Like, at a certain point,
right. It's
so difficult to build the swimming pool that you just use your neighbor's swimming pool. They had stuff like the tractor trailers, the transport trailer trucks, all needed to be 100 feet apart.
It's just, at one point, it's just untenable.
Yeah. Right. So you go, you can do this, but you can only have one person. Each person can only have one guest. So you can't bring your son, your daughter, and your wife. You could just bring your son or your daughter or your wife. You couldn't bring multiple family members. Everything's got to be spread out. You got to wear masks, you know, outdoors until you get into the car. Like, at a certain point, the city is so overzealous with the regulations, or the state or the county, that eventually they just go, oh, fuck it, scrap it, which has happened in a lot of places, obviously. And again, I get the part where diseases spread and more people get it when they're in contact, and droplets and masks and everything. I'm just saying, at a certain point, you have to weigh it against financial devastation and a sort of morality where this country is being broken. And it's like, there's comedy clubs are open basically all over the country with a handful of rules. But not the Irvine Improv, and not the Improv on Melrose, and not the Comedy Store, and none of them. And at a certain point, what I'm just saying is, whatever chances they're taking at the Houston Improv or at Zany's in Tennessee or wherever we're going in Arizona in 2 weeks, we're going to the Improv in Arizona, whatever it is they're doing, can't we just take the same chances that they're taking, which seems to be a balance? And it seems to be,
we're going to be last,
working out okay.
Or take the right chances as more information comes in, like adjust accordingly. We're seeing more and more stories now that being outdoors is much less risky than being in an enclosed space. What's more outdoors than a fucking car race? And if you wear a mask, everyone wear a mask and you're outdoors, then it's almost nil.
Well, either way, the last piece of hope I was clinging to is now been ripped out of my hands. So all we
are
can
you just
yes,
going to do donuts in the parking lot with Leno that weekend.
I'm just going to sit and eat donuts in my den. Put weight
in the
on
car in the car.
Yeah. So we got that. Hopefully the Trans Am race at the beginning of December is still on. So we'll keep you posted with that. Also, let's see. What did I write down? There's something I wanted to tell you guys about, which was, I like to make fun of what we've turned into as adults, and all the, Subarus are made with love. When I was going through LAX about 3 or 4 weeks ago, when we were going to Houston, I forgot to show you guys pictures of the Southwest personnel. They have a pep squad. Are you aware of that?
I didn't know that.
Excuse me?
They have cheerleaders in there literally holding up signs. Of course, I had to take pictures. Again, caveat, if I ever take a picture of you at an airport, it's to make fun of you. It's not because I appreciate what you're doing. Now, I'll walk up to you and go, that's such a cute dog. Can I take a picture of it? Or I love your tattoo. Can I take a picture of it? Or I'm thinking about getting some aggressive piercings as well. May I take a picture of it? Or Southwest, I love what you're doing for your clients. Let me take a picture of it. But you can blow it up there. Oh, Max Bass taking a picture of me taking a picture of those guys. But what does some of them say, Max Zapata?
Thank you. You are plain awesome. You're a star. Home is where the heart is.
Hold on. You're a star.
Yeah.
That thing of like, you're a star. You're a star for flying Southwest. I've flown Southwest 1,000 times. The only other celebrity I've ever seen on a Southwest flight was Ron Jeremy. I don't know. Is he B-list? Is he A-list or B-list? Like, is he hanging out?
He's BJ.
Depends
list.
On the year.
Is it possible that the "you're a star" card never comes out until they see an Adam Carolla type walking down? Like, quick, get the "you're a star" card.
Is there an airline, like, in a world where stars fly privately, right? And then maybe they'll fly like a Jet Suite X, or maybe they'll fly American first class and use the lounge or the secret entrance that the Kardashians use, you know, when they go through LAX. Where does Southwest land on that ranking, on that power rankings of stars live? There's never been a star that's flown Southwest. But anyway.
About a level above Greyhound.
Right. Yeah, somewhere between Greyhound and a donkey. That's where Southwest lands. In the star attraction, and they have like 6-7 people all standing out there holding up signs. This was, what was this, 7 a.m.? Yeah. I mean, we had like a 7:30 flight. First flight out. This is why I'd make a horrible Southwest employee. I'd be like, look, I do baggage handling. Do you really need me holding a poster board up, just standing in the lobby of LAX? And also, people have already committed to it. Like, we bought the ticket, we're leaving.
Yeah.
Not convincing anyone.
Right.
Were they, like, woohooing or were they silent? I don't know what would be creepier.
Modeling.
Yeah.
there was some vocalization of it. And,
Boy.
So I also then, I'm now into the New World Order because I was reading, or Gary Smith was reading to me about a lot of airlines. They're now canceling their drink service and canceling their meal service and all that kind of stuff. And of course, Southwest, for me, when they got rid of the peanuts, they've now replaced it with a snack mix, which I'm holding up. I dumped the contents of the snack mix out just so Vinny would cry like the Indian by the side of the freeway in the 70s. The snack mix
also is, Italian.
Is literally like 13 mini pretzels. It's got the mini pretzels. Mm-hmm. It's completely 100% comprised of mini pretzels, mini Melba toast, mini sort of Cheez-Its, and it's just a pack of salt-drenched carbohydrates. There's nothing. There's not a cashew. There's not a raisin in it. There's nothing. It's literally just flour and carbs pressed into a different form, and then the very sad can of water they hand you as well.
Can?
It's a can of water. I have no idea.
Very Spaceballs.
I have
no, Adam, you're a star.
Yes, this is... I'll tip it out and let you'll look at it. But yes, this is what there's no star. You would never could you, as I've said, it's a pretty easy rule. I've said all the time, how you know, Dr. Laura, Dr. Phil, Dr. Dre, Dr. J, Dr. Drew. I'm holding up the can. I'll show you the can. I said, look, you figure out Dr. Drew's Dr. Drew because if you're on an airplane and someone says we need a doctor, Dr. Drew stands up. Dr. Laura does not stand up. And
she just berates you for dying.
She slinks down so she can recognize. Hey, aren't you a... No.
My new move is, if you wouldn't eat it on the ground, you can't serve it in the air. If there's... I could not ever imagine a scenario where, like, Olga was leaving for the Gelson's, and I was like, oh, don't forget the super hard, stale, mini, salty, carby pretzel thing that no one enjoys.
Yep.
Has anyone ever eaten Fiesta mix or snack mix on the ground? It's a pile of empty carbs.
The only time you get something close to that and it makes sense is at a bar when you're drunk and you don't know any better and you're wasted. You're like, I just got to get some fucking food in my mouth.
Right. And the bar does it because it's free
and
it's salty.
And it makes you thirsty. Yep.
And it just makes you thirsty. So,
and do you know bars are mandated by law to offer some kind of food so you don't just drink yourself to death?
Really?
If you say, hey, can I have some beer? But that's the thing. They would get the cheapest shit possible because they're required by law. They want you to buy food, but if you're going to just get the free shit, they give you the carby load.
I usually just hang out at the gay bar and I reach into the fishbowl full of condoms and I just kind of
pop on,
just kind of peck away at that. Then I fart and it makes a huge bubble and then shoots across the room. It's funny.
Howie Mandel applauds.
That's
from
right. That's right, with his partner. Yeah. So anyway, we're now down to snack mix, no peanuts and a can of water and no drinks.
Can of water. What is a can of water?
It's this it, can.
Yeah. But it's not
deja,
bubbly. It's
that's
just
deja. That's deja blue, right?
Yeah, I had a bad canned water experience, which is a very Mike August experience. Which is Mike was asleep on our flight back from Tennessee, and she was coming by with the can of water, and I will get the cotton mouth at some point, and I said, Oh, give me a can. They looked at Mike. Mike was asleep. They started to kind of keep walking. And I went, no, I'll take a can. And she said, okay. She handed me a can of water. I put it in the empty seat between Mike and I. And then I took a nap. And when I woke up, Mike was just finishing off my can of water, which is a very
so
Mike
innocent.
Story.
That sounds about right.
Yes. All right. Let me hit Simply Safe. Number one sign of a bad home security system is it's complicated and you never use it. Yes. It's like not having a system if it's too complicated to use. Simply Safe, it's simple and it's faster. Designed to be easy to use while protecting your whole home 24/7. Order online. Open the box, place the sensors, plug it in, you're ready to go. Most people get it up and running in under a half hour. Peel and stick. It's like 3M sticky tape. The stuff is small and it's compact and it's streamlined, like all the sensors. And the batteries last up to 10 years. No technicians or salesperson to come walk around your house. No outrageous monthly fees. No long contracts. It is the best. It's named best overall home security of 2020 by U.S. and World Report. By the way, 24/7 professional monitoring, emergency dispatch, 50 cents a day is where it starts. It's Simply Safe, right, Dawson?
Head to simplysafe.com/Adam and get a free HD camera for our listeners. That's simplysafe.com/Adam to make sure they know that you listen to our show.
All right. Let's see. At the airport. I had a funny, a weird thing. I don't know if everyone is, everyone's, I think, pretty hypersensitive about race and race relations. And as I've always said, you know, that whole thing about never wanting to come across as racist or judgmental or anything. And I was at LAX, speaking of the airport, when we landed from Tennessee, and I said to Mike, I'm going to get myself a coffee before we hit the road back to our homes. And I was going to drive Mike. And he said, well, I'll go to the bathroom and you go get a coffee. And I said, yeah, fine. So I was standing in line at the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf. And people are kind of trying to do the social distancing thing in the line. But the problem is everyone just kind of creeps forward a little bit. And the 6 foot turns into more like 3.5 feet, even though that's larger than it would be, but it's still not 6 feet.
Still more symbolic.
Especially the airport when you've either just been or about to go on a plane where you're going to be pretty compact, like you're going down the aisle.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. We just flew in from Tennessee. Everyone was in line waiting to get on the Southwest flight, blah, blah, blah. So all the big celebrities, all the A-listers, I sat between Clooney and George Penn, I think. I mean, Clooney and Sean Penn, and I think Streisand may have been riding on the exit aisle. But anyway, I don't want to name drop, but we're in line. And I called Mike at a certain point because he went to the bathroom. And I said, you know, Mike, I'm in line, so don't head out to the curb. I'm up front. Standing in line. I didn't want to miss him. And he walks out of the bathroom, which is behind me. And he goes, oh, yeah, I see you. I'm just stepping out of the bathroom. I see I'm behind you. And I'm on the phone, but I just have the earbud in. And I turn around kind of sharply to see where Mike is, just to try to spot Mike behind me in the airport, because he's going, I'm looking at you, I'm behind you. And I kind of whip around, and there's a black couple standing right behind me, and the guy's got long dreads and the whole nine yards, and they didn't social distance. They're like 3 feet behind me, and I whip around like with purpose because I'm looking for Mike, and I see the black guy, and he goes, oh, Sorry. And he starts to step back. And I'm like, no.
Like, I literally started,
not you. Like, he thought I was doing this. What are you doing sneaking up on me? Like, get back. And he's like, sorry for the social dis. I was like, no. I'm not even down with the cause. I don't care. I was looking right past him at Mike behind him. But I blame Mike for that exchange. But I don't know how the guy could have interpreted it, because I don't think he knew I was on the phone. He just saw me whip around all of a sudden with purpose looking behind me. But that's the times we're living in. All right, we got Dr. Mark, and he's gonna tell us all about how to deal with the youngins in today's world, and probably maybe what those of us who have younger kids, what we can do about it to prevent this scourge from affecting them. We'll do that right after this.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all woke, no joke culture.
I love these as seen on TV products. I knew they were going to phase out the penny, but I didn't realize it had already taken a ton out of circulation and infused all that copper into socks, underwear, t-shirts, and work gloves. The ads always have some aged NFL player saying, I can use my hands again, thanks to copper fit gloves. Or my knees don't ache, thanks to my copper infused leggings. Or my wife had 5 orgasms last night, thanks to my copper fit condom.
Available now in all formats. Pick up a copy now at AdamCarolla.com.
Wow, we have clinical psychologist Dr. Mark McConville on. He's has a book called Failure to Launch, Why Your 20-something Hasn't Grown Up and What to Do About It. So interested in this subject, Dr. Mark. Thanks for joining us.
I am delighted to be here.
Well, what did we do, and what can we do, and what is the difference between a 20-year-old in 2020 and a 20-year-old when we were 20?
You mean when you were 20 or when I was 20?
Let's say when I was 20.
Okay. Well, you grew up in a different world than these kids are growing up in today. The job market was different. The amount of education you needed to kind of get a foothold in the adult world was dramatically different. The expectations. I know when I was 21, people told me I was an adult, and I was sort of dumb enough, naive enough to believe it. And even though I didn't feel it, I sort of faked it for a dozen years or so before it began to feel real. But there are the conditions that today's kids are growing up in are, they need more education. Education usually means tuition. Tuition usually means mom and dad, and mom and dad often means living in your old bedroom.
What about the self-esteem movement? I oftentimes sort of blame the self-esteem movement. I feel like you have to earn self-esteem. You can't just have it sort of bestowed upon you through a movement.
And the self-esteem movement, and, I'm sure we all have a trophy somewhere in our library that comes from that movement. It's pretty easy to make fun of because of its excesses and all this, the concern about the kid who couldn't throw the ball in from right field, and we wanted to somehow protect him. That's the sort of ugly, funny, vulnerable, easy to target side of that. But if you turn it over and look at the bigger picture, what really happened starting probably in the 80s and 90s is kids became... And adults became much more interested in kids. First of all, most of them were planned. It wasn't always that way. And so there was kind of a place at the table and maybe a 529 college plan right off the bat. And so the kids were very invested. And so what we have are the last several generations have been the most supported generations of youth in history.
Well, let me get to that point just for a second before we move on. That's very interesting because I did have a person say to me recently, do you think your parents planned to have you? Like, it doesn't seem like they were interested in having kids. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. They don't. My parents never wanted kids, or they didn't act like they wanted kids. So my kids, I did IVF. Like, it cost me a lot of money. It was a lot of planning. I mean, we did a lot of work to have my twins. Thus, we're probably going to approach those two individuals much differently than my parents, who probably didn't want to have kids, or many parents who had families by mistake. So already you're already starting off at a deficit in a way, but maybe that deficit turned out to be a positive. I don't know. I'm sorry. Continue.
Well, you don't hear much about the stork anymore, right?
Right.
The stork retired. He was active in my day, but you're right. I mean, you're a great example of it. You've incredibly invested these kids. You didn't say, like you might have 50 years earlier, like, oh, good, we have two more farmhands, someone to gather the eggs, right?
Right.
You're thinking, like, what's the right preschool? What are we going to do to give these kids the best opportunity? So my point is just, you know, the part that's easy to ridicule is the self-esteem movement. But the part that's really commendable is this might have been you, Adam. I don't know, but 14 years old, you're sitting in eighth or ninth grade. You have no interest in what's going on. Your daydreams are a mile away, and the teachers and the adults kind of gang up on you because you're irresponsible. You've got a crappy attitude. You're refusing to get serious about life, and we fast forward 20 or 30 years, and we say, no, wait a minute. He's got a learning disability. It's actually not his fault. And so once we began to see these things, not through these sort of, you know, as moral character traits, but actually we began to establish a science of learning, then we were much more able to address that kid and at least give him or her a fighting chance for making something out of their education. So, you know, that's the upside of that generation.
What are some tips for folks who are running businesses who are looking at employing some of these people who come from these environments?
Well, I run into this all the time. Don't hire your own kid. You are just asking for trouble. But getting that kid out into the world where they're answering to someone other than mom and dad, it may be stacking fruits and vegetables at a grocery store. It might be carrying a golf bag for somebody at a country club. I think that's what I call letting the world begin to parent your kid. And what we see over and over again is, you know, you've got a teenager who's a complete pain in the ass, and then you run into his supervisor from the grocery store who says to you, oh my God, we love your son. He could not be more helpful. He couldn't be more responsible. And you scratch your head and say, wait, do you have the right family? And it's because they get out there in the world and they're much more likely to take that job seriously because they've got an adult that they don't have 16 years of history with and someone that takes them seriously. And they feel like I'm making a contribution.
Right. Well, what about the person that runs that supermarket who gets that 19 or 20-year-old who they don't have any relationship with, but that person doesn't appreciate the tone that their boss is speaking to them in, or wants to be approached this way or that way, or just the sort of general, the thing I've really started to learn about is just a sort of like lots of me days and what I'm willing to do and what I'm not willing to do. How do you bridge that gap as the boss?
Well, I've read but haven't directly experienced about the generation of kids coming out of college and even law school today that are saying, no, I work 40 hours a week. That's it. You know, it's kind of hard to make it as a young lawyer if that's your attitude.
Well, speaking of young lawyers, I was standing around at a barbecue once talking to a successful lawyer, and he'd, you know, made partner, and his name is up on the masthead and everything. And he said to him, he had a young sort of junior lawyer in there once, and he announced to this guy and everyone at the law firm, which is, he's going on vacation, and during that vacation, do not even attempt to call him with any kind of business whatsoever, because he's not going to pick up his phone. And the senior attorney said to me, I go on vacation and I always tell everyone if there's a situation or emergency, I can be reached. And what that did for the older guy who had already made partners, he just looked at that young guy and thought, you're never going to make partner. And mm-hmm. and that hurt that kid's career, right? Theoretically.
Well, he needs to do more than just think you're not going to make partner. He needs to pull him aside and tell him. I don't have a lot of expertise in coaching law partners, but I'll tell you, the guy that owns the grocery store with the 19-year-old, he has an extraordinary advantage over mom and dad. And that is, he can say to that kid, you know, we don't really need you here. And if you can't do it according to Hoyle, we're going to let you go. And so that's, you know, again, I'm not a business owner, so I don't know what it's like. I know some people are really good at managing young help. Some aren't. My expertise is parents, because the parents don't have that luxury. You know, they're not going to say, pack your bags. It's not, maybe if it were 1952, they might have done it, but it's not going to happen in 2020.
Well, related question then, Mark. So all three of us are parents of between 3 and 14. What can we do as parents to sort of prevent this this arrested development? You know, what it gets to be early 20s.
That's a great, great question. In one interview I did, I got a caller that said, what can I do to help my 3-year-old not turn into one of these failure to launch kids who's, you know, living in the basement?
I'd like to know.
And I thought about it, and I'm not, I don't know a whole lot about 3-year-olds, but my wife was a preschool and kindergarten teacher for 40 years and is really the most child expert professional I've ever encountered. And what she would say is, well, the next time you go into the playroom, you sit down on the floor and say, we are going to put these toys away together. Come on in here. And you collaborate with that child and model for them a level of accountability and responsibility that is appropriate and comprehensible to a 3-year-old. Now, if we fast forward, you know, parenting is high maintenance. Your kid comes in and drops her book bag in the foyer, in the mudroom, and then goes in and makes a snack and leaves crap all over the place. And you come in, you can clean that up in probably 20 seconds, maybe 30. But for you to walk up the stairs, knock on your kid's door, open that door and say, honey, we got some work to do. No, no, no. Turn your phone off. Turn your phone off. Come with me, and to go down and put the book bag where it belongs and clean. That, you know, you've just invested a good 15 minutes, and you had to deal with scowls and snarls and stomping up the stairs. That's parenting. It's a shitload of work.
But it works, because to your point, in high school, somebody gave my mother that piece of advice, and she got us out of bed at night to go move our shoes. And guess who stopped doing that? The laziest hoarder on the block, me. And I really, that really did make a difference. So I think it works.
No question. I had this painfully strained relationship with my father, who was truly of an earlier generation. And he wasn't post 60s. So he did not care about having a personal relationship with his sons. What he cared about is, we did the frickin' yard work the way it's supposed to be done, and we did it on time. And so it happened all the time. Like, I'm getting on my bike to go to Little League practice. He says, you're not going anywhere. Get back here. Then he would get me down on my knees. I'm picking weeds. I'm doing something to his incredible specs. And, you know, I hated him for it. And fast forward to graduate school, and I absolutely, no questions asked, outworked every other student in the program. I did everything quicker, better, faster. And I remember stopping saying, where in the hell did I, who is sort of, you know, my by nature kind of lazy, where did I learn this? And I thought, oh, yeah, the old man. Mm-hmm. The old man, he drilled it into me. Here it is. I'm making use of it. Thank you, Dad. Thank you.
Conversely, I didn't get discipline or structure at home. And I remember being, I don't know, 19 years old and realizing, sorry, the screen had a little snafu, but we'll bring it back. But I was 18, 19 years old out of high school. And I was like, oh, you don't know anything and you have no structure. And now the only structure that I really had was knowing I didn't have structure. That was like the one piece of information, like knowing that I come from chaos and sort of lethargy and, you know, hands-off parenting. And I didn't have the great Santini for a dad. I didn't have a great anything. So I actually realized it and started imposing it on myself, knowing that I was going to need it at some point. And also life kind of imposes it on you as well when you're poor and you have to do manual labor and that kind of stuff. But, you know, for anyone listening who didn't come from that environment and may not possess those traits or skills, you can go out and seek them. It's probably not, it's going to be tough because you're not going to be attracted to it, but you can go out and seek that structure. And there's a version of it where it's a self-imposed structure. Again, it's probably most 18 and a half year olds aren't going to do it, but I did it. I knew I was going to have an unsuccessful life. I knew I didn't know how to work. I knew I was undisciplined, uneducated, and was going to have a very long and difficult life with no vacations, no air conditioning, and no sports cars. So I imposed it upon myself. And I don't know if I've ever really fully even gotten over it. I still kind of impose it on myself, just knowing where I come from. So there's a version of it where you can realistically assess what you can do and what your weaknesses and shortcomings are, and impose that on yourself. Doctor, thoughts?
I would say if you could only have a single gift from the gods, you would want that gift to be self-awareness. And you're a great case in point. You know, you were the toolbox apparently was empty in all kinds of ways, but there was self-awareness. And with that, you were able to sort of purchase all of the rest. You turn that around. You look at the person that's got whatever your background is, your set of your profile of strengths and weaknesses. And let's take away self-awareness. And I'm going to suggest that they may be living in a box under a bridge somewhere.
Yeah.
White chasm.
Funniest guy under the bridge.
I don't know where I got that, but it was, you know, I did it for selfish reasons. You know, I think a lot of people don't want to deal with their shortcomings because they want to sort of go easy on themselves. For me, it was like, I like myself. I would like to have some semblance of a life. I would like to have a credit card. I would like to have insurance. Mm-hmm. I would like to drive a car that didn't have a bench seat in it and a, you know, tow hitch hanging off the bumper. I wanted those things. So I sort of imposed it on myself because I liked myself and I wanted that life for myself.
You became your own parent.
Yes.
I mean, that's essentially what you did. And look, even if you grew up with Ozzie and Harriet, the fact is your parents do not finish parenting you. When you hit that age, 18, 19, one of the core developmental tasks is you move out in the world and you find other people that know stuff you need to know, whether it's your supervisor at the supermarket, whether it's a professor in school, whether it's a senior member of the construction crew that you belong to. That knack for picking out, this guy knows something I need to learn, and then cultivating that as a resource, that is hugely important. Mom and dad cannot finish the job.
So based on a couple of things you said, I'm gathering that a high school job or job in that teenage years is pretty important. Ironically enough, I worked at a grocery store for 2 years, so I know what you're talking about. Like, yeah. You know, the boss is the boss. You can't like, you know, oh, come on, mom, come on, dad. Now we live in LA and there's a lot of kids who, let's just say, they will never need to have a high school job. Talk about the importance or non-importance. I'm guessing you think it's important, but talk about it.
Right. I've seen kids that sort of fit that category. Trust fund kids from very wealthy families here in Cleveland, where the parents just, they had this attitude that said, you've got to do your part. You've got to contribute. You know, I want that new skateboard that everybody's got. Well, that's wonderful. You can have that. So let's see. Your half of that would be $125. Is there some way I can coach you and help you? I mean, you're only 12 years old, but 12-year-olds can earn $120. You know, you can. It's a kind of attitude from the parents that says, I am going to cultivate that personality trait in you, even with students. You know, in some families, they say, well, being a student, that's your job. And there are some kids that take it like a job and they self-manage. They become their own supervisor. I wrote a piece on college readiness in the New York Times, and I made the point, being just slightly dramatic. I said, if you've got an A student, and that A student is an A student by virtue of you nipping at his heels and the tutors that you have procured and the SAT course that you've set up for him, versus you have a C student who completely owns his or her academic life. It belongs to them. You're not involved. They are the supervisor. That kid is a much better bet for college success than the first kid with the higher average. Now, you can learn that personality trait. You can learn it in a grocery store. You can learn it caddying on a golf course. There are a lot of places you can learn it.
Well, as I've discussed, when we grew up, that existed, so there was no reason to simulate it. You know, the skateboard for me growing up, or the bicycle for me growing up, was no one was going to buy it for me, so I had to go mow a bunch of lawns. I mean, I remember when I wanted to buy a used unicycle when I was 10, and the unicycle was probably $15, I had to wash all the cars in my dad's apartment complex on a couple of Saturdays at, you know, a buck a car. And then I went and bought this unicycle, used, fixed it up, learned to ride the unicycle. But that was all a great lesson for me. None of those rules apply to my kids, because they can just go to Amazon and have a unicycle show up at the doorstep the following day. So now I must bizarrely get into this game where we create something that doesn't exist, where I go, I can afford to buy a unicycle. I'm not going to buy a unicycle. Go wash my car that I can afford to have washed, and then I'll pay for half the unicycle. So you're literally, it's like what you're talking about with the make the snack and leave the mess out. I'm actually going to burn more calories trying to get you to get some skin in the game of this unicycle or bicycle or skateboard or whatever it is you're wanting, video game. I'm going to burn more calories getting you invested in it. Otherwise, you're going to grow up in this zero gravity environment.
Right. Well, you know, I would only point out you signed up for the job.
That's true.
And that's just, you know, I like to quip, although there's a lot of truth in this. You never find rebellious adolescents living on farms.
Right.
And that's because their work, their purpose, their contribution is real. It's not manufactured. It's not artificial. We don't have to construct it in some way. And that is part of the real challenge and art of parenting kids today. It's creating a sense of necessity.
Right. Right?
And that's where you talk about what motivates us to learn the shit that we really would much rather not learn. It's necessity.
Always.
And that's the art of parenting.
Dr. Mark McConville is the name. Failure to Launch, Why Your 20-Something Hasn't Grown Up and What to Do About It. It's available now on Amazon. And if you're going to go there, you might as well get my book, my new book as well. The website, markmcconvillephd.com. Mark, we're going to scoot along and play a little Mr. Brightside, but I appreciate you coming on the show and enlightening our fans.
Yeah, and I just want to comment that you, hearing you talk about your book, now I know my why mine is only number two.
Adam's number one in parenting.
Thanks, Dr. Mark. We appreciate it. Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's do a little Brightside. You're going to have a do you have a an opening ready?
Yep, ready to go.
Here we go.
Life got you down? Can't catch a break? Thinking about ending it all? Well, don't. Let Adam turn your frown upside down. It's time for Mr. Brightside.
All right. Diederik, 33, from Netherlands.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good. What's going on? Let me put a little happy spin on this for you.
All right. Well, my wife and I, we're currently trying to conceive, and with all the crazy nonsense going on in the world, we were talking the other day, like how can we send our kids to a school where they don't get indoctrinated with all kinds of crazy ideas, with the crazy lefty hippie bullshit and the tranny wow. shit and all the crazy social justice nonsense that's going on everywhere now.
I would tell your wife, by the way, by the time your kid gets to school age, we'll just be living in two separate Americas. Like that wall.
She won't be living in any Americas.
Oh, sorry. Well, two separate worlds. There'll be the wall that Trump wants to build on the Mexican border. That's just going to go across the middle of the globe. It's going to have this
like,
going to around
like
the globe.
Snowpiercer. Yeah, around the globe.
And that's it. You'll just be on one side of it. And that one side will be, practicing martial arts and going to the firing range and homeschooling and churning your own butter and thatching your own roofs. It'll be one big barn raising. And then the other side will just be whatever that Xanadu is in Seattle, where a bunch of people are kicking around a hacky sack, making a bathtub patchouli oil, blaming the government, except for there won't be a government anymore, talking about microaggressions and systemic racism, and they'll be on the other side of the wall, and you'll be on the side with the guys with the Mennonite beards who are churning their own butter. And living a happier, simpler life like Jeremiah Johnson. Look it up, bitches, or Man in the Wilderness. We'll be back. It'll be like that M. Night Shyamalan movie, right? We'll be living in
the village.
The village. We'll be living
it'll be like a cliffhanger after Stallone dropped that girl.
That's right. Or M. Night, or whomever.
Don't worry too much.
No. What it's going to do is it's just going to create. There's going to be a separation, and I think there's always going to be a market for folks who think like you or don't think like this new sort of all woke, no joke people. And again, that's why the MMA is as big as it is. I mean, the MMA never needed to exist because everyone sort of lived in the middle. We didn't need this kind of extreme stuff or something like a Tough Mudder or all these fitness challenges or anything. It was unnecessary. I mean, think about how everyone was just in the middle. And now people are either having fast food brought to their home or they're on day 11 of a cayenne pepper and salt water cleanse. You know what I mean? Like it's one or the other. You're just going to pick a side, and you guys will do your homeschooling, and then you'll indoctrinate your young child into your cult, and then at a certain point you'll ask him to go find other young ladies specifically to bring into your cult and indoctrinate them into. So don't worry about it, Derek. I mean, Dietrich. Sorry.
Feel better?
Feel better?
Okay. Well, I guess we're already doing that stuff. You know, we're both doing martial arts. We're both doing our own, a lot of our own cooking, and you know, cast iron pans and
we
shit.
Know what side you'll be on?
Yeah, I think there's a side, just like this whole pandemic lockdown thing. One side started doubling down on the Grubhub. The other side started doubling down on making their own casseroles. And that sort of, it's a little window into everyone's tendencies and psyches, right? If you think about it, by the way.
Sourdough starters right there. Sourdough starter.
Right. But it's a window.
Eating chili I just made.
Right. A window into the psyche. The pandemic is the pandemic. So somebody says, hey, you have to stop going out and doing business as usual. And you stop. And if you're wired like Gina and you're wired like Christy, you go, okay, good. I'm going to start baking at home, or I'm going to start making my no sugar, no grain lifestyle. I'm going to start exploring that world. And I'm going to then go further down that road. Lynette took a slightly different path.
More or less the same?
Well, the point is everyone went a little bit further down the road they were already on, right? So yep. The folks that were formerly into fitness found more time to work out. Those who were not eating great, maybe drinking a little too much and a little too sedentary, started drinking more and watching more TV. All it did was expose everyone's, all it did is propel everyone a little further down the road they were already on.
Right.
That's
hypercharged.
That's all.
Can I tell you, this is sort of a every mother's nightmare, sort of a TLC way to look at it that I'm afraid of. And as we've pointed out before, I probably won't have to worry about it much longer anyway, if worrying about it at all. You know, something that scares me personally and that has always scared me about having kids, when I watch a horror movie or a thriller movie and they have to protect their child, I don't see that as, oh, my God, this precious thing. I see dead weight. And I go, man, if we're in a pandemic or if we're in nuclear winter and now I got this guy I got to worry about, that's a non-starter. So, Mr. Brightside, please help me.
Yeah, because they slow you down, right?
Yeah.
It's a food source.
It's like...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's protein there.
A bargaining chip.
Baby jerky. And also... yeah, that's why, you know, all the guys in Vietnam, when they're in country, it's like, don't make friends. Yeah. You don't know when that guy's going to step on a bouncing Betty.
Could be gone tomorrow.
That's right. So you don't want to make friends with your kids. That's a good idea, Gina. I agree.
That's what I meant.
I agree with you, Gina. Gina, you're right.
Don't bond. Connor, 25, Boise, Idaho.
Hey, yeah. Hi, Adam.
What's
Gina
called.
Big fan. Been listening to you guys for a couple years now.
Thank you.
All right.
So I was actually at lunch with a couple coworkers here in Idaho because we can do that. Mm-hmm. And when I got the Twitter notification and there was a baby screaming and that the parents just were not paying attention. So I kind of want to get your opinion on that. I thought that segued into today's episode a little bit.
We had a few babies screaming on our Southwest flight, as I recall, on our way in from Tennessee. It's tough, especially like when their ears start popping. And I always think about it, which is I am very self-conscious about the people around me. And if my kids started screaming, I think I'd want to put a blanket over their head or drape it over their head or
it's
something.
It's so hard, man. It makes you so self-conscious.
Trying to muffle it. Here's the deal. To put my Mr. Brightside spin on it, you and your young, free Boisean buddies who are out there having a microbrew and some hummus, you have to deal with that kid screaming temporarily while you're out eating in your free society. But that kid's not coming home with you and keeping you up that night and getting you up the next night after that. So, you know, all of you who have that experience of like, oh, I passed a homeless guy and he shit in his pants and it was gross. Yeah, you passed him and then you kept walking. Now, it was gross, but it was temporarily gross. But the homeless guy, that walking around with a load in his pants is a full-time job for him. And that parent with that screaming little bundle of joy is a full-time job for them and him and her. So you were momentarily sort of inconvenienced. I mean, we've all had those jobs where you go like, oh, you walk into the bathroom at the airport. It's like, oh, it's gross in here. And then you realize there's a guy, all he does is clean this bathroom.
Yeah.
That's his job. That's where all he spends. Or sometimes you'll go into some weird little business, a liquor store, a restaurant or something in a weird part of town, or a gas station. You'll ask for directions or grab something real fast. And you go, I want to get out of here. I'm going to spend any time here. And then you realize that person lives in this world full time. So that mom and that dad live with that little creature full time. For you, it was fleeting. While inconvenient, fleeting, Connor. And that's why they call me Mr. Brightside.
Feel better? Good. Thank you, Mr. Brightside.
Connor, what do you do for work?
I'm a banker. I work for an ag finance company. So it's funny that Mark mentioned farming. I grew up on a farm out here, so now I'm a banker for farms.
But you're the bank.
Salt of the earth.
Oh, no. He's the banker.
No, he's the man.
I bet John Mellencamp hates your guts. I'd hate to get caught between John Mellencamp and Neil Young if I were you, because I bet they
don't
hate
go to any farm aid.
Yeah, I bet they hate your guts because you have to foreclose on the farm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had to yet.
Oh, okay. Well,
but I'm young still, so.
He's only 25.
The theme for like every fifth movie I saw before the age of 20 was the banks taking the farm, the crop.
Before closing.
There's a lot of like the bank coming and take the farm.
Field of dreams. Field of dreams.
It was a lot of, that was a white man's burden back in the day. The bank man was coming for the farm. And it was, you know, in your family for generations. And by the way, if this fucking plot of land in Nebraska has been in your family for generations, shouldn't you have fucking paid it off by now? Why is the note so fat on it? I mean, that acreage in Nebraska when your great great grandpappy bought it in 1861, that thing had to be 10 cents an acre. What's the note? Didn't he put enough down?
Adam, it's obviously because he plowed over his whole corn crop to build a baseball field.
This is the subplot of John Cougar Mellencamp's reign on the Scarecrow, where his old high school friend comes to foreclose on the farm and says, it's just my job, John. I hope you understand. He goes, hey, calling it your job, old hoss, sure don't make it right, but I'll say a prayer for you tonight.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Blood on the
Scarecrow. Say a prayer for your soul.
Let's
That's right.
Blood on the Scarecrow. Something on the plow.
Rain on the Scarecrow. Blood on the plow.
There you go. But no one really asked a logical question. Again, in your family for generations, back in the day, that land was pennies an acre.
Yeah,
what happened? I'm guessing they don't get into the nuances of the refinance that was done at some point.
Took out a loan to make
Right. But you think about it. You probably refinanced it and bought something stupid like an RV with two Harleys or something. That's on them. I'm sorry, John.
Sorry, John.
That's not on
Connor, you could use that.
That's not on them. I mean, because the plot was always, it's been in the family for generations. So everyone. All right, anyway. I don't know. What was that? Get that song. Get that John Cougar Mellencamp song.
I love that song.
It's a good one.
I like that song, too. All right. We'll find that. We'll take a break. We'll do some news. You got it?
Yeah.
Now, let's see what happened. Why do they owe so much on the farm? Crops, bad.
Well,
bad
the crops
yield.
He grew last summer weren't enough to pay the loan, as he says in the song.
Oh.
Yeah, I think we got ourselves a hell or high water situation where the bank gave him just enough money to screw him.
But it must have been a refinance, right?
Sure.
It's not a new farm.
It was a reverse mortgage.
You took out a loan.
Sniff through on a wooden cross, blackbird in the barn. 400 empty acres that used to be my farm. Grew up like my daddy did, my grandpa cleared this land. When I was 5, I walked the fence while grandpa held my hand.
All right, hold on. Grandpa tilled the land. Come on now. It's got to be paid for.
I'm going off of memory because I've heard this song 5 million times. I love it. He takes out a loan at some point, and the crops he grew last summer weren't enough to pay the loan.
Yeah, okay.
So, Brian, you're saying that he screwed his own legacy.
That's kind of on him. Sorry, all right, let's bring it down. All right, John Cougar's
like,
here we
go.
Hold
couldn't
my
buy the seed to plant? Yeah. So, I couldn't buy the seed to plant this spring, so the Farmers Bank foreclosed.
Went to auction.
When John Cougar, when he wrote that song, was smoking and fucking a model. And went, I have in a penthouse in Manhattan and went, I got an idea for a song, sweetie. Let me wipe my cock off. Write this thing down.
His daughter is a reality star now. She's a fucking smoke show.
Is she?
Oh, really?
She's on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Oh,
Teddy Joe.
Is she? Because I know his second wife was a smoke show too, right? Or his first wife.
Elaine Irwin?
Yeah.
Whatever the one that was in the, yeah, the video.
That was in the song Small Town. I married an L.A. doll and brought her to this small town.
Jesus Christ.
What else would you like to know about John Cougar Mellencamp?
I think we've got our fill. All right, let me hit Geico, and then we'll take a break and do some news. Geico, everyone's apart these days. You're sharing your dance move and DIY haircut fails. How about you let Geico do a little sharing? They want to get in the act. Go to Geico. Geico.com, they're doing a give back. 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers, because Geico's committed for the long haul. The 15% credit lasts the full policy term. Just go to Geico.com/giveback. All right, let's take ourselves a quickie break. We'll come back. We'll do the news right after this.